case against the ABC began in federal court this week.
We dissect the conflict between the personal and the professional for journos on social media and what it means for impartiality.
And does the ABC's new comedy Optics get anything right about PR? We're not so sure.
That's in 30 minutes on ABC Radio National with me, Tim Burrows.
And me, Vivian Kelly. Catch you then.
ABC News with David Rollins. Two men remain in custody after facing court for allegedly displaying the flag of a Nazi swastika at a hotel just metres from Sydney's Jewish Museum. Danuta Kazaki has the story.
New South Wales Magistrate Greg Grogan described the alleged display of a Nazi symbol in Sydney's Inner East as disgraceful, disgusting and abhorrent in the Downing Centre local court today. Two men were charged under New South Wales laws after a flag with a swastika was publicly held up at the Darlow Bar in Darlinghurst yesterday afternoon. 51-year-old Craig Elston remains in custody after pleading guilty. The court heard he was a collector of war memorabilia and was reportedly showing the flag to his friend while seated on an outside table. 44-year-old Charles Cameron, who is accused of taking photos of the flag, has been refused bail and is yet to enter a plea.
A Victorian man has been charged with allegedly making death threats and anti-Semitic comments to a federal MP. The 33-year-old Melbourne man has been charged with four counts of using a carriage service to menace, harass or cause offence, along with one count of using a carriage service to threaten to kill. Australian Federal Police will allege the man used social media and email to contact a New South Wales-based federal MP several times in mid-January, making death threats and anti-Semitic comments. Victoria Police will also allege the man used social media to contact a Victorian-based state MP last month. The man has been granted conditional bail and will face the Melbourne Magistrates Court again in April. Outgoing ABC Chief Content Officer Chris Oliver Taylor has told a court there was pressure from above to replace radio presenter Antoinette Latouf, despite advice that there was no reason to remove her. Ethan Ricks reports.
Antoinette Latouf is suing the broadcaster in the federal court after she did not present a morning program on ABC Radio Sydney for the last 2 days of a 5-day casual contract in December 2023. That decision came after the journalist shared a Human Rights Watch post on her personal Instagram, which said starvation was being used as a tool of war in Gaza. Mr. Oliver Taylor says he felt pressure from then-chair Arta Buttrose to replace Ms. Latouf after being forwarded multiple complaints. The court heard acting editorial director Simon Melkman had initially advised Mr. Oliver Taylor that there was no evidence or reason to remove Ms. Latouf. The ABC argues the chief content officer was the key decision maker and Ms. Latouf being taken off the air.
Veterans have told a parliamentary hearing there needs to be a significant overhaul of military honours and awards and have demanded an apology from former Defence Chief Angus Campbell for his mistreatment of soldiers. A parliamentary hearing has been told that General Campbell was a traitor for smearing Afghanistan veterans after stripping the meritorious unit citation following alleged war crimes. Former Special Forces Officer Dan Fortune says there must be an apology.
Now, what we're not here to do is talk about sour grapes. This is not about disaffected veterans having a crack at the title. We want not retribution, we want redemption and a future purpose-fit system that people can believe in.
Employees of US aid organisation USAID have been left in shock after widespread cuts from the new administration of President Donald Trump. Unions are challenging the decision in the courts. Its employees have been ordered to stop work by Elon Musk and his Department of Government Efficiency. USAID employee Christina Dry says she's been told her contract won't be renewed.
It was just complete shock. We weren't sure what was happening. And then once people started leaving, once they started monitoring the content we had on our websites, when we started watching career civil servants being walked out of the building, then it was just complete flabbergast.
New Zealanders expressed shock at the revelation that the Cook Islands is planning to sign a major agreement with China and has considered issuing its own passports. New Zealand's Foreign Minister Winston Peters says his government has been blindsided. The Pacific country is a protectorate of New Zealand and its people are Kiwi citizens. The plan to issue separate passports has now been put on hold after Wellington warned that islanders would risk losing their New Zealand passports. Russia says its forces have repelled a series of fresh Ukrainian attacks in its Kursk region, 6 months on from Kyiv's unexpected military incursion. Moscow says repeated counterattacks have been fought off.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Donald Trump to slap sanctions on investigators of the International Criminal Court. Also, a state by-election in Victoria this weekend being watched closely by the federal, Labor and Liberal parties. And we meet a snake catcher who removed more than 100 red-bellied black snakes from a Sydney mulch pile.
I've started to sift through the pile and after a couple of minutes some baby ones came out and the total number was 102. It's pretty crazy, yeah.
First this evening, the International Criminal Court is the latest global body to be sanctioned by the US President Donald Trump. In one of his latest executive orders, he's accused the court of, quote, baseless actions targeting the US and Israel, and promised financial and visa restrictions on anyone who assists in ICC investigations of citizens of the US and its allies. Last year, the court issued arrest warrants for the Israeli Prime Minister and his former defence minister for alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. The ICC order comes as President Trump repeats his proposal for the US to take over Gaza. Isabel Massali reports.
After nearly 3 weeks in office, US President Donald Trump once again has the whole world talking about another executive order, this time issuing sanctions against those who work for the International Criminal Court. The exact scope of the order isn't yet known, but Associate Professor Carrie McDougall says one thing is clear.
This is an absolute travesty in terms of, you know, the rule of law.
She's an expert in international criminal law at the University of Melbourne and previously worked for Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, representing the nation at meetings of the ICC.
It will have very significant impact on the ICC's ability to carry out its work. And to be frank, it's, you know, clear US exceptionalism and hypocrisy, because of course just recently the US supported ICC action against President Putin.
The ICC is the peak global court for international crimes, dealing with crimes against humanity, war crimes and genocide. The United States and Israel are not members, along with Russia and China. But Professor McDougall explains on a case-by-case basis there has been a high degree of cooperation from the US, like in facilitating the arrest of people wanted by the ICC. She says it's clear this action is in response to the ICC issuing arrest warrants against the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defence minister over allegations of war crimes and crimes against humanity related to Gaza, which are allegations Israel rejects.
The ICC has been engaged in over a year for planning for a worst-case scenario because the ICC's bank accounts are US-based. A lot of the technology that they rely on for their day-to-day operations, including in relation to their investigations, are based in the US. So, you know, depending on exactly how these measures are implemented, it could effectively, at least for a period, bring the court's work to a halt. And, of course, you know, is a clear signal that persons committing serious international crimes will, if the US has anything to say with it, get away with those crimes.
Donald Rothwell also points out the impact may not end there. He's a professor of international law at ANU.
There'd be concern that if the International Criminal Court is in the crosshairs, what about the International Court of Justice? Of course, the International Court of Justice is currently considering a case against Israel brought by South Africa with respect to alleged acts of genocide by Israel as a result of its Gaza campaign. So where does this possibly stop? The US has had a track record of hostility towards the International Criminal Court.
And while the ceasefire in Gaza continues, President Trump has doubled down on his controversial proposal for the US to gain control over the Strip. But he's clarified that Israel would hand over the enclave once the fighting stops and Palestinians are relocated elsewhere. In a post on Truth Social, he said,
"The Gaza Strip would be turned over to the United States by Israel at the conclusion of fighting. The Palestinians would have already been resettled in far safer and more beautiful communities, with new and modern homes in the region. No soldiers by the US would be needed."
Amid widespread condemnation of Mr. Trump's proposal, US Secretary of State Marco Rubio will visit the Middle East next week. The US State Department says Mr. Rubio will travel to Israel, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar and Saudi Arabia from February 13 to 18 and would pursue Mr. Trump's approach of trying to, quote, disrupt the status quo in the region.
Isabel Massali. The result of a crucial state by-election in Melbourne tomorrow will be closely watched by the Labor and Liberal parties at both the state and federal levels. Voters in the seat of Werribee in the city's southwest are going to the polls because of the resignation of the long-serving Victorian Treasurer, Tim Pallas. Labor holds the seat by a margin of just under 11%, and it's going to be an early electoral test for Victoria's new Liberal opposition leader, Brad Batten. And it'll also give us an idea of whether the fortunes of the Allan Labor government are on the slide as badly as recent polls suggest. Our reporter David Escort visited Werribee.
The next station is Werribee. This train will terminate at Werribee.
It might seem like a small state by-election in an outer suburb of Melbourne, but the stakes in Werribee could not be higher. Sitting about 32 kilometres southwest of the CBD, the town is part of one of the fastest-growing regions in the country. And under the weight of that population boom, locals think infrastructure is buckling. Marie Camillo works at the local florist just off the bustling town centre.
Well, there's lots of things that we need in Werribee, like more doctors at the hospital, more in the emergency area. You sit there for hours and hours. I sat there with my sister for 8 hours one day and still didn't get any result.
Werribee has been a safe Labor seat for more than 40 years and the party currently holds it by almost 11% margin. But voters like Marie will have their chance to give a performance review of the state Labor government, which has been in power for more than a decade. The by-election was triggered by the resignation of a high-profile local member, former state treasurer Tim Pallas. And the outcome here could have national consequences. Just a few months out from the federal election, the Liberals are focusing their campaign on outer suburban areas like Werribee, where inflationary pressure has been mounting and anger growing with incumbent governments. As he listens to the concerns of voters, local publican Nick Christie thinks it's the basics the state government isn't getting right.
For example, we've got a courthouse that's been built down here near the police station. And as you look at that courthouse, they've built it, but they haven't got the money to run it. The police spend half their time running backwards and forwards from the Sunshine Courthouse and the Werribee Police Station, which takes our police off the road. And then when you need police to attend an incident, they're not available because they're under-resourced. So there's certainly growing pains.
The Wyndham Law Courts, which was set to be the largest court complex outside of the CBD, was allocated $272 million for construction in 2020, but it presently sits empty, failing to alleviate the burden on stretched law enforcement staff in the area. Nick Christie thinks the messages of both parties are struggling to get through to voters.
It's interesting because 5 years ago, if you had a conversation about politics, you'd be nervous to have that conversation. It doesn't happen anymore. Now everyone's on the same page.
While Labor remains the favourite to win the seat, it's seen as a litmus test of Labor's fortunes, particularly around the direction of the Allan state government. Dr Zare Gazarian is the head of politics at Monash University.
There are, at the moment, shifts in what the polls are showing us in Victoria, and they seem to be going one way. They seem to be going against the Labor Party, making this seat a very tough test for the Labor Party and the Premier, Jacinta Allan.
Do you think that the by-election will give us an idea of national sentiment towards Labor or perhaps Victorian sentiment towards Labor?
We know in Victoria, opinion polls have shown that it's got a diminishing support base, and at the national level as well. The coalition seems to have bounced back. Labor is now trailing in the two-party preferred measure. So the challenge for Labor is to maintain the idea that it is still a fresh party with fresh ideas.
Back at the florist, Marie thinks it's a reminder locals should not be taken for granted. Do you think either party, Labor or Liberal, are speaking to you in those terms at the moment?
Not really. They always promise these things, but they never give. And we are sick of it.
A by-election will also be held in the inner Melbourne seat of Paran, which isn't being contested by Labor. The Greens have held that seat since 2014 and will be fending off a challenge from the Liberals and a former Labor MP who's running as an independent.
David Escourt reporting. Well, as I mentioned earlier, the Werribee by-election in particular will be closely watched by the federal Liberal and Labor parties. The opposition leader, Peter Dutton, and his coalition are hoping they can flip outer suburban Melbourne seats at the federal election and win government. So could a bad result for Labor in this state seat of Werribee be a sign the Liberals can do well in Victoria? Paul Strangio is an Emeritus Professor of Politics at Monash Uni.
If Labor does badly in Werribee, and certainly if it loses the seat of Werribee, which is on a margin of 10.9%, if it was to lose it or go very close to losing it, it would confirm what opinion polls are showing, and that if the tide is running out fast for Victorian Labor, the Victorian Labor government, that of Ms. Allen, very fast. And as it goes deep into its third term, and it's now over 10 years in office. Now, of course, that has implications. This is the state in which has been a citadel for federal Labor for decades now, and it would confirm that the Labor brand is suffering in Victoria. So I certainly think it would then have serious implications. Now, the first thing to say, it wouldn't signal that the federal seat that takes in Werribee, Layla, on a margin of nearly 13% is vulnerable. That's just not in the ballpark. But it will encourage the Liberals, who are touting that they can pick up 4 and maybe even 5 seats in Victoria at the federal election. They're the seats of Aston, Chisholm, Goldstein, McEwen, and perhaps Dunkley.
I know you can't read the minds of voters, but to what extent do you think in Werribee they'll be sending federal Labor a message about things like the cost of living?
At one level, I think the cost of living tips into everything. But the feedback that seems to be coming from voters, and this has been around for a while in traditional Labor areas in the outer suburbs in Melbourne in the north and in the west, is the sense that they feel neglected by state Labor, that they're being taken for granted. And in that sense, I think the Victorian Liberal Party, and that's in pretty typical ham-fisted fashion, have made a mistake in pre-selecting an underwhelming candidate who doesn't live in the electorate. And that may well be a blockage to them claiming the seat. But I think largely this would be an expression of dissatisfaction with the Allen government and how long Victorian Labor has been in office.
There has been the common wisdom, I guess, for a long time that Australians tend to vote for one party at the state level and another at the federal. So does that mean it's a bit difficult to read anything into what Werribee tells us about the federal poll?
Well, it might well be the case that if the people of Werribee, for example, take out their anger about Victorian Labor at this by-election, you know, they would themselves be less prone then maybe to punish Anthony Albanese come the federal election. I think a really interesting question historically, Sam, is will this be something like the 1990 election? That was a time when we had another Victorian Labor government, that time led by John Cain, which was on its knees, and its unpopularity caused the Hawke federal Labor government to have a near-death experience. So will history be potentially repeating between 1990 and 2025?
And Professor Strangio, there is a second by-election on in Melbourne tomorrow in the inner city seat of Paran. Labor isn't actually fielding a candidate, so it's seen as a contest between the Liberals, the Greens and an independent who's a former Labor MP. Does that poll have any federal implications?
Look, I don't think so. I don't think it's been a good look for Labor to stand aside. It tends to, again, signal that they're very conscious of the poor position they are currently in Victoria. So I think just generally it potentially contributes to a lowering of morale here. And, again, this has been an absolute bastion for Labor, both at state and federal level now for decades. But the mood at the moment is certainly, it looks like it's changing.
Paul Strangio is an Emeritus Professor of Politics at Monash Uni. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, a senior Australian judge accuses Donald Trump of posing a threat to democracy. At the Antoinette Latouf unfair dismissal case in Sydney, an ABC manager has given evidence that he felt pressure from his superiors to take the journalist off air. Ms Latouf is suing the ABC after she was removed from a short-term hosting role on Sydney Radio in 2023. It came after she'd shared an online post critical of Israel's actions in Gaza. Manager Chris Oliver Taylor told the federal court he warned the national broadcaster's managing director there'd be an outcry if Ms Latouf was removed before her contract ended. Our reporter Rachel Hayter is following the case. Rachel, what has Chris Oliver Taylor told the court today?
Mr Oliver Taylor has been questioned today about what direction Ms Latouf was given in terms of her online presence while she was employed by the ABC. He told the court he understood Ms Latouf was instructed not to post anything that related to the war, as opposed to anything that would suggest she's not impartial in relation to that war. There's also been a lot of discussion in the federal court today about what it means for a radio presenter to be impartial, what perceived impartiality looks like, and whether any obligation for a radio presenter to be impartial applies at all times or only when they're at work.
And Rachel, what did Chris Oliver Taylor tell the court about his role in the decision for Antoinette Latouf to be let go?
Mr Oliver Taylor gave evidence, Sam, that he felt stuck between a rock and a hard place due to the pressure he was receiving from the ABC's outgoing managing director David Anderson and former chair Ita Buttrose to replace Antoinette Latouf on air, and the conflicting advice he'd received from acting editorial director Simon Melkman that Ms Latouf had not breached any editorial guidelines. Chris Oliver Taylor said he advised the ABC's managing director that the blowback, if Ms Latouf was removed, would be phenomenal. He also told the federal court there should have been more due diligence in the hiring of Antoinette Latouf, in making sure she was the right person to be presenting live on the ABC in December 2023, at a time when the Israel-Gaza war was in the news headlines so often. Very late in the day after sustained questioning, Chris Oliver Taylor said he believes Antoinette Latouf's Human Rights Watch post breached the ABC's personal use of social media guidelines, saying it demonstrated bias. That was after previously telling the court he didn't have a view on whether that post was impartial or not. The court's been adjourned until Tuesday. At this stage, there'll be five more witnesses to appear, including the ABC's former chair, Ita Buttrose.
It's our reporter, Rachel Hayter. In a rare foray into political commentary, one of Australia's most senior judges has criticised the American president, Donald Trump, and warned he poses a risk to democracy. The Chief Justice of New South Wales, Andrew Bell, made the comments in a speech to a dinner for the Law Society of New South Wales in Sydney last night. Elizabeth Cramsey has more.
When it comes to political matters, the impartial judiciary usually remains pretty tight-lipped. But speaking at a New South Wales Law Society dinner last night, the state's top judge, Chief Justice Andrew Bell, weighed in on one of US President Donald Trump's first acts since returning to power, pardoning almost 1,500 people involved in the January 6 insurrection.
There can be no doubt that its exercise in these cases does and has gravely undermined
the rule of law in the United States.
And Chief Justice Bell preemptively answered any audience members who might think his comments were inappropriate.
As Lord Hodge of the United Kingdom Supreme Court put it in 2018, democratically elected governments have a vital interest in the maintenance of the rule of law. It is a bastion against those who would use chaos as a ladder, he said.
He also expressed concerns the pardons could encourage groups in Australia who believe they're above the law.
And there have been security incidents involving sovereign citizens and the courts at various levels, the judicial hierarchy in New South Wales in recent years, including a death threat to one of my colleagues.
Then he turned his focus to matters involving the legal profession. To become a lawyer in Australia, graduates must undergo practical legal training, also known as PLT. It takes 15 weeks full-time and is the final hurdle before admission. Chief Justice Bell says he contacted the College of Law, a not-for-profit, to express his concern about the cost of PLT fees.
I discovered, to my surprise, to put the matter mildly, that the college has been generating an average surplus of almost $16 million per annum over the past decade and has accumulated retained earnings of just under $180 million.
Geoffrey Watson SC is a barrister and the director of the Centre for Public Integrity.
If a young lawyer needs to fork out yet another $12,000 after paying out all of the fees that they've paid to become qualified in the first place, it's just becoming too burdensome.
He says it disincentivises the best and brightest budding lawyers from taking positions with community legal centres or legal aid.
You have at one end these very, very large firms, they're quite often multinational firms, and they attract, I'm afraid, the brightest of the students. And one of the reasons they're so attractive to students is, for example, they're paying this PLT fee. And because of that, these same students won't go to work at, say, a community legal centre because they'd have to pay it themselves.
Chief Justice Bell says the college has reduced the fees to a base of $9,200.
Elizabeth Cramsey. Well, a Sydney snake catcher has had a frightening call out after more than 100 venomous snakes were found in a backyard mulch pile. His discovery came as authorities warned of an increase in the number of snake bites in New South Wales as sprawling suburbs put humans and nature in closer contact. Here's Kimberly Price.
At first, it seemed like an average call out for snake catcher Corey Kirawaro and his team after a resident noticed a few red-bellied black snakes hanging around a large mulch pile.
They'd done a bit of research online and realised that red-bellied black snakes can sort of gather together and use it as a birthing site.
Corey Kirawaro says the owners called for a bit of advice and his team decided to go have a look.
Dylan went out on Friday afternoon and started to sift through the pile, and after a couple of minutes, some baby ones came out, and we weren't expecting any baby ones yet, to be honest.
As the team pulled out five adult red-bellied black snakes into a bag for protection, some started to give birth.
By the time we got them back home to check over them properly, the other ones had given birth, and the total number was 102.
Due to the large number of snakes, Corey Kirawaro consulted local authorities to work out the best location for their release, which will happen when the weather cools.
We've chosen a location where there's in a national park where no one like has access to, really. I was going to release them today, but the weather's a little bit too hot, so if I release them and it's too hot, they can stress out. They can overheat and they'll die.
The New South Wales Poisons Information Centre reported a 35% spike in snake bite calls over the spring and summer period compared to the same time last year. Dr. Timothy Jackson is the co-head of the Australian Venom Research at the University of Melbourne and says the rise is complex.
Unless we can track that kind of increase in incidence over a number of years and correlate it with some other variable, say climate change or perhaps degree of urbanisation, the null hypothesis is that this is a statistical blip.
However, increasing housing developments could be a reason for more snake sightings.
If you're living in an area that until very recently was bushland or a relatively undisturbed habitat for wildlife of all kinds, there's of course a somewhat increased chance that you might encounter wildlife.
Despite the increase, Dr. Jackson explains bites are still rare.
In terms of snake bites that require medical attention in Australia, around around about 300 to 500 people require antivenom every year. Red-bellied black snakes are highly unlikely to bite you.
So, how venomous are red-bellied black snakes? Brian Fry is a professor of toxicology at the University of Queensland.
They're certainly quite toxic. So while a little lab mouse may be toast, you know, humans probably going to be all right.
However, the experts urge people not to approach snakes and to call their local catcher.
Kimberly Price. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is Gavin Coote. Technical production by Nick Drakoulis, Lena Alsadi, Joel Kassam and David Sargent. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back on Monday evening. Have a great weekend. Good night.
This is ABC Radio National.
Welcome to Media Land, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
What a mess. Antoinette Latouf's unfair dismissal case against the ABC has been dominating the media this week. But she's not the only journalist to lose a job over social media posts. We look at the friction between the personal and professional for journos online.
And we dissect the ABC's new PR comedy Optics. What does it get right, if anything, about the world of spin?
Before we go there, though, Viv, Australia's TV streaming landscape is about to change again. Warner Brothers Discovery is about to launch their service, Max, into Australia. Recent days we've seen them announcing their creative and media agencies, which is always a sign something is about to happen. If you're a fan of HBO series like White Lotus, Succession, Euphoria, or House of the Dragon, then that means a whole new subscription if you want to carry on watching them.
I guess people currently are watching those programs on Binge in Australia. That's the subscription platform that has